Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. In the Declaration of Independence, the founders wrote, "All men are created equal," a noble and radical idea at the time. But saying something and making it happen are not the same. Take the fundamental right to vote. Obviously, the 3 to 4 million human slaves in America could not vote, and it took 100 years after the Civil War's end for African Americans to be guaranteed that right. Women did not get the federal vote until 1920, and Native Americans until 1924. Significantly, Montana led in women's suffrage. This year, 2014, marks the 100th anniversary of that hard-fought victory. Martha Cole, historical specialist with the Montana Historical Society, knows something about the fight. Martha, many thanks for joining us on Homeground.
Thank you.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. My parents are both college professors. My dad's a biologist, and my mom is an anthropologist. And she actually came to Montana long before I did. She was interested in studying women and their role in society.
This is ringing a bell.
It is.
I know. Is this where you got interested in women's issues and history from your mom, would you say?
It could be. But she did one of the seminal pieces on farm women in the 1960s. She did her dissertation up in Maple Creek, Saskatchewan. And then she expanded that work to include Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Montana. My first trip, actually, to Montana was as her research assistant, where I spent just hours photocopying things that she pulled from the archives.
Well, sitting here, I can see, you know, you are enthusiastic about this subject and this story. Do you remember any moment when history seemed what you wanted to specialize in? Where did it come from to you?
You know, when I was in high school, I read a book called The Waning of the Middle Ages, and I was fascinated by the idea that the world was not always the way it is now, that things had once been really different. Everything had been different. The way people thought about things were different. And part of that is this great promise of possibility. That means that things don't have to be the way they are now either. And so that book was incredibly important to me. And for a long time, I thought I wanted to be a medieval historian.
So what made you shift in your specialization?
A combination of not knowing Latin and needing a job.
And where did that occur, not speaking Latin and needing a job?
I first got a job at the Missouri Historical Society as an assistant editor for a magazine called Gateway Heritage that modeled itself very much on Montana, the magazine of Western history, published by the Montana Historical Society. And I worked there for about 7 years, ultimately becoming editor of that. And then I moved to Montana.
When did you get here?
1995. And I came here to be actually editor of the Montana Historical Society Press, but have since moved on from that to my current position.
And what is a historical specialist in layman's language? What do you do?
I do a lot of different things. I do a lot of curriculum development. I do a lot of teacher training, trying to help them implement best practices for
history. You mean in the public schools?
In the public schools.
Mm-hmm. And the curriculum development is also for the public schools?
It is. And private schools and homeschoolers use it. It's material that we created, the Historical Society, for everyone to use. I write interpretive signs, a lot of the historical plaques that you see, those National Register signs that you see, I write those. And I get to do special projects, like the Montana Women's History Matters project that we've put together for this year's centennial celebration.
Tell us about that project. What is it comprised of?
Well, we decided that in honor of women's suffrage, we wanted to use that as an excuse to look at women's experience in Montana more generally. And the core of that is a website that we have, montanawomenshistory.org, where we're posting two articles every week on a huge variety of topics.
And how long will you be posting these every week?
Through the end of the year. And then the site will remain static. We also have information on historic places, lesson plans, links to primary sources, links to research material. And at the end of the year, we're going to gather all of these essays that we've been posting and put them together into a book.
Let's start the discussion with the suffrage campaign. I said at the outset Montana led by 6 years the federal granting of women getting the vote. What's the background of that story?
Well, it starts earlier than that. I mean, the federal background is the 1848 Declaration of Sentiments. But when it comes to Montana, women had the vote in the territorial period for schools and if you own property on tax issues. So the vote that they didn't have equal suffrage, so they couldn't vote for political representatives. But they were always allowed to vote in school elections.
From territorial time.
From the very beginning, partly because it was really seen that the home and children were a women's purview, and schools are very much a part of that. And so women were allowed to vote in school elections.
Didn't know that. So tell us about the transition, what happened and why and who made it happen.
There were so the very first attempt was when we became, we were writing our constitution to become a state. There was an effort to put equal suffrage in there. It didn't pass. And then every 2 years when the legislature would meet, there was a move to get bills introduced. They were introduced. But because of the way the constitution was written, what needed to happen was they needed to pass with a two-thirds majority in both houses and then go to a popular vote of the people.
Now, the constitution you're referring to was adopted when?
In 1889, when Montana became a state.
Okay, so that's a very high hurdle, two-thirds in each house and a majority of the vote, an election of men, right?
Yes.
So who led the effort? What were the dynamics? Who was the opposition?
You know, the effort was led by different people at different times. Ella Knowles Haskell, people might have heard of. She was the first female lawyer in Montana. She was the head of the Women's Suffrage Association for a time.
My recollection was she had quite a remarkable story in pitching to the Bar Association that she should be allowed to take, I think, the bar exam, and then having passed it, become an attorney.
Yeah, she actually had to lobby the legislature to allow her to take the bar, but she won them over with her amazing oratory. But then even after she became a lawyer, she couldn't find anyone to hire her. And the story goes that one downtown merchant, she kept on going back and back saying, you know, can't I offer you my services? And he finally said, well, you can go. I have all these lady customers who borrow umbrellas when it's raining and they never return them. You can go, here's, go find my umbrellas. And she went and she found all of those umbrellas. And at first he got really angry because some of the women were mad. But then everything calmed down and he became one of her best clients.
You're listening to Home Ground and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with historical specialist Martha Cole of the Montana Historical Society about women's suffrage in Montana. Any other particularly colorful individuals that made a difference?
The most famous is obviously Jeanette Rankin, but I think that there's maybe even too much focus put on her because this was a mass movement. This was not a movement of one person. And while she did do amazing things, there were other people like Maggie Smith Hathaway from Ravalli County, who's one of my favorite women.
Why?
She was called the Whirlwind. She traveled more miles campaigning for women's suffrage than Jeanette Rankin did herself. She and Jeanette Rankin did not get along, by the way.
Traveled how?
By train.
Around the state?
Or all over the state.
Doing what?
Meeting with organizations and stumping for women's suffrage. You know, I don't know if she spoke on the streets. I know that Belle Fliegelman Weinstein spoke on the streets. She writes about how her mother was shocked that she was being so unladylike as to be on a street corner. She also talks about a time that she and Jeanette Rankin went up to Marysville to campaign among the miners, and they campaigned right outside the bar. And the men said at the end of their speech, give us a little dance, and so they did.
Let's break this into a couple of pieces. First, you said it wasn't just, you know, leaders. You said it was a mass movement. How were everyday women involved? They worked hard in the house. It was a traditional situation. Women and children, some of them had regular quote-unquote jobs. What kind of organization of women was there, broadly speaking, in Montana?
There were a lot of women's organizations at this time. The Missoula teachers, women teachers, published 30,000 leaflets saying that teachers deserve to vote, and they passed them out. One of the most powerful women's organizations was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, And they had members in every town and every county in Montana. And they came out for suffrage. They worked with the churches. They did home meetings.
Temperance as in not drinking alcohol?
Absolutely.
Okay. And what about the audience? It's the male voters. They're being pitched by women who say, we deserve the vote. The men, whether they wanted it or not, are in a position of quote-unquote cultural superiority, just in fact by having the vote. What were the arguments women used?
They promised everybody everything. So they brought in campaigners from outside, including Margaret Hinchey, who is the Irish washerwoman from New York. And they had her speaking to union men in Butte and then up in the logging camps up in Libby and Eureka in that northwest corner of the state, where she said, women need the vote because we need to protect women and children workers. Women will vote with their hearts, they'll vote morally, and they'll vote for things like child labor laws and eight-hour days for women.
And they pitched that to working men.
To working men, who they pitched their class interest. Women are going to support us in terms of a class interest. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was talking to conservative congregations, to all the, you know, Norwegian, you know, Lutherans out there in eastern Montana, saying, if you give women the vote, we'll vote out alcohol. Every argument that you can find, they focused on what would attract that particular man.
I'm looking at something you kindly provided, which looks like a political leaflet. It's called Women's Suffrage Vote Yes, Because, and there are four arguments. And the third argument, the print's a little hard to read, the home demands it. The fourth is the worker needs it. What does the home demands it mean in that time?
Again, women were seen as responsible for the health of their family and their home. But the argument was that you couldn't be responsible for keeping your children safe at home if there was typhus in the milk, if your water supply was polluted, if there were unsavory influences on the street. So as a mother, you were obligated to enter the political arena and to right some of these wrongs.
Obviously, the vote was 1914. What was the result?
53% in favor of women's suffrage, 47% opposed.
Any record of any partying afterwards?
Certainly not with alcohol.
Now, we mentioned at the top of the show that Indian people did not get the vote at this time. What's that story?
Well, American Indians weren't considered citizens. They were wards of the government. If you renounced your tribal affiliation, then you could vote. But if you stayed on the reservation and maintained your connection to your tribe, you were not allowed to vote. And what happened was really World War I, and Indian men served with great distinction during the war. And so as a reward on some level for that service, they received the right to vote with the Indian Citizenship Act.
Federal.
Federal. One thing that you have to know, though, two things. One is that there were Jim Crow laws in the South to disenfranchise black people. There were similar types of laws to try to disenfranchise Indian people in Montana.
What is the Jim Crow won't mean a lot to a lot of people. What are we talking about, try to disenfranchise? What do you mean?
There were laws that made it very difficult for Indians to vote. In the South, among blacks, they passed laws that you had to take literacy tests. You had to pay poll taxes. So there were all sorts of attempts to keep black people away from the polls after the Civil War, even though officially they had the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
In Montana, we had different efforts, but with the same effect. So that in 1932, there was amendment to Montana's constitution that permitted only tax-paying individuals to vote. So if you received your income from trust lands, as many Indians did, you were disenfranchised. They also were laws that said that if you didn't pay local taxes, you couldn't become a local registrar. In other words, you wouldn't be able to register people to vote, which made it harder to get Indians registered to vote. So there were all of these efforts to keep Indians from having political influence, even after that 1924 law. As for black people, you get the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that changes things here.
Let's go back for a second to the broader theme of your women's history project called Women's History Matters. I'm going to hypothesize something. But it's not a coincidence that Montana, and I think Wyoming, as Western pioneer states, led in women's suffrage. I'm going to argue in part it's because of the role women played in homesteading, in the very difficult activities that one had to engage in, and in that fundamental respect, proved their mettle by natural survival. Crazy idea? Not a crazy idea? What would you say as a historian?
You know, I don't think anyone really knows. That is a very common theory.
Sorry to hear that.
We definitely know that that suffrage moves from west to east. There's a lot of community building activity that's going on in Montana. Lots of organizations that women are involved in, like the Grange. So women are involved in churches and the like. So I think that, you know, just their significance to their communities, and they do prove their worth in all sorts of ways.
My recollection is women were, for example, I'm going to push my point a little bit, active in the homestead movement, contrary to our sort of stereotype of the guy on the horse riding out and staking the claim. True, false?
Absolutely true. The mining frontier was a male frontier, but when we brought homesteading in, we're talking family, and we're talking single women. About 18% of Montana homesteads were taken out by solo women.
One out of five solo women.
That's right.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about women's suffrage and women's history in Montana with Montana historical specialist Martha Cole. I'm looking at a photograph of two very spare old-time frame cabins sitting 5 feet apart. It looks like a child in between them, in the middle of nowhere, somewhere out in the plains. What is this photograph?
Those are twin homestead shacks. And I love that photograph because we do think of homesteading as a lonely activity out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the plains. And yet here we're, in this case, a married woman whose husband was an alcoholic and she was her sole means of support. She came out alone to homestead, but she didn't really come out alone. She came out with neighbors and friends, and she built right on her line, and her friend built right next door. So although they were both homesteading themselves on their own 160 acres, they could borrow a cup of sugar.
You mentioned that in this particular case, the woman was married to an alcoholic, abusive husband. Is that more than just coincidence, or was that part of the reality of women homesteaders?
It's an important point because the law says that married women cannot actually homestead. So a single woman can, a divorced woman can, a widowed woman can. But it has to be the head of household, which is the man, that homesteads, unless you can prove that you are separated for good reason, you know, that he's an alcoholic and he won't support you.
Prove
and you
as
are,
in court?
As in, she had to have testimonials that she submitted with her claim.
You mentioned earlier that part of the pitch for women's suffrage in certain circles was support for prohibition. How did that actually play out when it happened?
You know, a lot of people were scared that women's suffrage would bring on prohibition, and that's why a lot of men voted against it. And in fact, they were right. Montana passes prohibition ahead of its passage nationally. But not all women supported prohibition. And one of the interesting things that we found are women bootleggers. It turns out that if you have cooking skills, bootlegging is a lucrative opportunity.
Now, I've never heard of woman bootleggers. You're telling me this is part of our history in this state.
It absolutely is. It takes your domestic skills and it monetizes it. And it's something you can do at home while you watch your kids.
Something else you mentioned was the role of women in building our communities. What specifically do you mean?
75% of libraries are estimated to be founded by women. I mean, what you have to remember is people are coming out here and they are creating from scratch towns.
Right.
They need to build churches. They need to build schools. They need to build parks. They need clean water. They need infrastructure. And those were all things that women were very much involved in, again, from that stance of motherhood. and creating a good, healthy environment for their children to grow up in.
Just one point. We interviewed Helen Caldwell about the one-room schoolhouse. She did a book about it. And what struck me about that was, of course, the women teachers. They were overwhelmingly women. It's hard to find the words, the commitment, dedication, and grit they showed, and the community commitment to provide Montana's children with these schools and facilities and teachers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the homesteading frontier was very progressive in that way, and they were really not that lone cowboy that you mentioned before. They really were interested in creating community. In some ways, that community commitment on the part of women still continues. Church work is a really good example. There's not a church in Montana that wasn't built on strawberry festivals and lefse, suppers and lutefisk, fairs and stuff. And that's still, if you go to a church today, a lot of that work is done by the Altar Guild, by the Ladies' Society, by the Women's Group, both fundraising and then the practical maintenance of the church. The same is true in terms of these new communities with services like hospitals, healthcare. Women are the ones that started the hospitals in Montana, and they were generally religious women. So the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth brought out women to Virginia City, and Helena in Butte. And there was a nun they called Sister Beggar in Butte because she stood outside the mine entrances and had men donate so that they could build their hospital. Here in Helena, it was, again, the women that created St. Peter's Hospital. It was proposed by the wife of the Episcopal bishop. Her name was Henrietta Brewer. And it was her and the other women of the church that made this happen. They not only raised the funds, but they also volunteered cooking and cleaning at the hospital because they couldn't afford to pay workers. So it was this real labor on the part of really middle-class women who didn't have to work for a living. Mm-hmm. At this period, you had men that went out, and if you were middle-class, the woman stayed home. But what we think of as staying home, she would have a servant to help her cook and clean, and so she had time, and that time often went into these kind of community-building enterprises.
It's hard for me not to believe with that history that you've just outlined, which is somewhat unique to the West. It's institution-building in the contemporary world. It's real time. That the suffrage debate took place in the aftermath and during that sort of work. And I'm going to argue with you, the historian, had to affect men's sense of, by golly, these women have been great, they've earned it, they've built our communities, they should have the right to vote. Do you think I'm crazy?
You could very well be right.
That's a cautious response.
It's a historian's response.
All right, so women get the vote in Montana, at least quote-unquote American women in 1914, and everybody lives happily ever after, right?
Not so much. I think one of the great kind of misconceptions is this idea that progress is linear, that there's a steady march toward freedom and progress. And in fact, the world is what we make of it. And it changes all the time. And it's not always in a forward direction. It's not always the direction of more opportunities for women.
How do you mean? I mean, we look today and we have women corporate executives, women on the Supreme Court, a woman getting ready to run for the presidency of the United States, women in the Senate. What's the problem?
We have about 5% of our commercial pilots now are women. That might be a number that surprises you. That means 95% of commercial pilots are men.
So what's the history with that? That's not random that you select that.
It's not, because if you look at earlier times, there were many more women pilots. When the airplanes were first coming in, you had women barnstorming all over the country, partly because the industry wanted to prove that air travel was safe.
When you say women were barnstorming, you mean flying the planes?
I absolutely mean flying the planes. The very first airmail service in Helena was a woman who came in 1913, Catherine Stimson, to the county fair. And as a stunt, she picked up mail at the fair and dropped it at the Helena post office.
And if you go to the Helena airport, you'll see a photograph of Amelia Earhart 10 or 15 years later.
And she was one of the 99s. I mean, there weren't a ton of commercial pilots, but they did exist. And then there was another woman from Montana that was one of the first women, one of the first 99 women to get her commercial pilot's license. But my point is that women were perfectly capable of flying when it was a stunt. But when it became a routine job, all of a sudden, it was much harder for them to break in.
Or a well-paid job, as a matter of fact.
And a well-paid job. They were perfectly capable of flying as WASPs during World War II when the military needed women pilots to transport supplies. In the 50s, it was much harder for them to break in.
I'm just reminded I had interviewed Sandra Day O'Connor, obviously the first woman appointed to the United States Supreme Court. She graduated number 2 in her law class at Stanford behind William Rehnquist and couldn't get a job, she told me. Back to Montana, one could argue that airline pilot is a fairly rare job. You have brought a photograph of a woman's crew standing in front of an old-time locomotive. They're covered in oil and coveralls. What's the story with this photograph?
You know, it's another example of women stepping up and having employment opportunities when they're needed. In this case, it was during World War I. Everyone knows about Rosie the Riveter during World War II, but World War I also opened up opportunities for women, and they were hired by the Great Northern and the Northern Pacific to do these traditionally male jobs. They were engine cleaners in this case. One of the great things for those women was that those were union jobs, and so it was one of the few places where they were actually paid equally to their male counterparts. But after the war, the men come home, and the jobs dry up for women.
So let's take the long historian's view. You say progress isn't linear. Some of it's unarguable. We now have, instead of Sandra Day O'Connor not being able to get a job, 3 women on the United States Supreme Court. Montana had a Chief Justice, Carla Gray, et cetera, et cetera. Title IX opened up athletic competition for women all across the United States in the 1970s. What's your sense for, quote-unquote, progress? How does it happen, and where are we, and what needs to happen in the future from your perspective?
You know, I don't think anything is given to you. I think the reason that we have Title IX is because it opened up these athletic opportunities for women is that women fought for that law. And I think after that law was passed, women sued for their rights under that law. So progress happens when communities organize to make progress happen.
Martha Cole, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.